On October 3, 1980, a bomb was detonated outside a synagogue on Köpernick Street in Paris. 3 decades later, French investigators finally identified a suspect in the case. A Lebanese-Canadian sociology professor living a quiet life on the outskirts of Ottawa, Canada. Is Hassan Diab guilty?
Can you introduce yourself?
Or is he a scapegoat?
Hassan Diab.
From Canada Land, this is The Köpernick Affair. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Ukraine's president came to Washington to sign a deal. Instead, his meeting in the Oval Office descended into a shouting match.
You've allowed yourself to be in a very bad position, and he happens to be right about it.
From the very beginning of the war,
you're not in a good position. You don't have the cards right now.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. A dramatic meltdown for American diplomacy. Also today, Mexico just sent more than 24 of its most wanted cartel members to face trial in U.S. courts. That sounds like a big deal. However,
this is a PR coup, but operationally it means very little.
We'll hear about one of Spain's last makers of hand-cut glass and the television shows airing during the Islamic holy month of Ramadan.
It's all over Instagram. It's all over social media. Everybody's talking about them.
All those stories and more ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for tuning in today. It was a highly anticipated meeting in the Oval Office, and it went completely off the rails. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was there to talk about cooperation with the U.S. on rare earth minerals and to sign a deal with President Trump. Instead, the meeting, which included both Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance, turned into a shouting match. It was a shocking display of open animosity at the highest level of international diplomacy. The World's Daniel Offman is on the line with me now from Washington. Daniel, can you remind us what the expectations were going into this meeting today?
Yeah, Carolyn. The expectation was that the U.S. and Ukraine were beginning a process that would lead to a ceasefire in Ukraine. So today the plan was for the U.S. and Ukraine to sign a lucrative rare earth minerals deal that would benefit both countries and provide some security assurances for Ukraine's future. However, earlier in the afternoon, the meeting, as you said, completely devolved into a very heated argument that played out on live TV. And now the two sides have cut off the meeting because of this public clash.
Right. So give us a rundown of exactly what went down in the Oval Office today.
So I've never seen a meeting devolve into something like this before. You know, at least at the beginning, the two sides were cordial. Then Zelensky questioned what a ceasefire with Russia would look like without robust U.S. security guarantees. And in response, Vice President J.D. Vance went on the attack.
You should be thanking the president for trying to bring it into this conflict.
Have you ever been to Ukraine? Did you say what problems we have?
I have been to...
Come once.
I've actually watched and seen the stories, and I know what happens is you bring them on a propaganda tour, Mr. President. Do you disagree that you've had problems?
So that's how the argument started, and then later President Trump joined in as well.
You're right now not in a very good position. You've allowed yourself to be in a very bad position, and he happens to be right about it.
From the very beginning of the war,
you're not in a good position. You don't have the cards right now. With us, you start having
cards. I'm not playing cards.
Right now, you don't have cards. You're playing cards,
Mr. President.
You're playing cards. You're gambling with the lives of millions of people. You're gambling with World War III. You're gambling with World War III.
An extraordinary exchange there, Daniel, and a serious accusation at the end from President Trump. What do you make of all this? What should we take away about this canceled meeting? What does it mean?
So I believe President Trump spelled out the U.S. position on Ukraine like this.
The problem is I've empowered you to be a tough guy, and I don't think you'd be a tough guy without the United States, and your people are very brave. But you're either going to make a deal or we're out. And if we're out, you'll fight it out. I don't think it's going to be pretty, but you'll fight it out.
So what we're hearing there is the president saying that essentially the U.S. doesn't stand by Ukraine as it has until now, and that U.S. support is conditional, and the condition for that support is that the U.S. calls the shots. So there was a sense earlier this week that the meeting would bring the U.S. and Ukraine closer together, that a joint business venture would show that the U.S. has skin in the game and that it would be motivated to support a prosperous future Ukraine. After this meeting, it looks like the U.S. is taking a step back and telling the Ukrainians that they'll need to fend for themselves.
So given all of this, given what happened today, is the rare earth minerals deal dead at this point?
I still think it's too early to say conclusively, but it looks like this deal is definitely on pause. And what if we take a step back, what President really wants is a grand deal. He wants a deal to end the war completely. He said that many times. But he needs both Ukraine and Russia to buy in. Otherwise, such a deal won't happen. So today was certainly a step back in finding a way to end the war in Ukraine.
So last question for you, Daniel. President Trump made a point this afternoon of saying he was not taking sides, but certainly many do see him as taking on Russian talking points. If we zoom out beyond the U.S.-Ukraine relationship, what does this mean for the actual war in Ukraine?
Well, even before the public clash today, many in Ukraine and in Russia have been skeptical about the idea that the war was going to end anytime soon. And there's little evidence that Russia is interested in ending hostilities in Ukraine. And although Trump said today that the U.S. holds all the cards, both Russia and Ukraine, they're the two countries that are confronting each other on the battlefield. So this scenario, though, that is playing out right now, it's one of the scenarios that European leaders perhaps feared the most. The prospect of the U.S. disengaging because of spoiled relations with Ukraine. I can also imagine that in Moscow, Kremlin officials must be ecstatic right now about these developments, a situation where the U.S., Ukraine, and European countries are all fighting amongst themselves as Russia gains ground on the battlefield. And that looks like a larger security crisis for Europe.
The World's Daniel Offman speaking with us from Washington, D.C. Thank you for your reporting on this, Daniel.
Thank you so much, Carolyn.
Whatever happens in Ukraine going forward will have enormous significance for the United States' traditional allies in Europe. Earlier this week, French President Emmanuel Macron and the British Prime Minister Keir Starmer also met with President Trump, and the war in Ukraine was at the top of their agendas. Our Europe correspondent Orla Berry is following the story. Orla, before we do get to those visits, can you tell me what the reaction has been in Europe to President Zelensky and President Trump's White House meeting?
Well, everyone is astonished. Everyone is completely gobsmacked. The Prime Minister of Poland just tweeted a few minutes ago, "Dear President Zelensky, dear Ukrainian friends, you are not alone." Keir Starmer hasn't tweeted a response to it yet. He's been tweeting on other matters, but the head of the opposition Liberal Democrats Party, Ed Davey, just posted and said, "This is thuggery from Trump and Vance, plain and simple." So, you know, we went from having such a kind of a warm, friendly exchange between the UK Prime Minister and President Trump yesterday to a fire hose of insults. You know, nobody, I think, expected that it would end up like this. And some people are saying here in Europe tonight, I don't know how Europe and US relations can recover from this.
Wow. Those are some serious statements. You mentioned that the meeting between Keir Starmer and President Trump was pretty chummy. Of course, Trump also met with Emmanuel Macron this week in the White House. What were their goals there? How much was it focused on Ukraine?
I mean, it was very much focused on Ukraine. And the idea was to see that the U.S. was still on side, or at least that was the hope at the time. But there was also a bigger issue, Carolyn, that again will be, you know, up for question tonight. And that's the transatlantic relationship itself, because there have been a lot of fears over the last few weeks and month, I guess, that relationship is crumbling. The Europeans have had 80 years of American-backed security, and now the feeling is that there's a real tectonic shift in that relationship. Many in Europe feel that the sort of the EU and UK and Europe is simply not a priority for the US. You know, even before today's meeting with President Zelensky, you had President Trump on Wednesday night saying the EU was set up to screw with America. So Starmer went to Washington with that kind of rhetoric in mind. The thing is, we knew that even if Starmer and Macron managed to win over President Trump, as they appeared to this week. There was also the question of his inner circle. There's the question of the likes of J.D. Vance and Elon Musk, two people who've been very openly anti-EU, very openly siding with far-right parties in Europe who have no interest in keeping the EU together. They have Donald Trump's ear every day. So Keir Starmer and Macron would have been very well aware when they left the White House in the last few days that, you know, they board their planes and go back home. But Trump is still listening to his inner circle, as we've seen maybe has played out today.
So as you mentioned, the meetings with Emmanuel Macron and Keir Starmer had a very different tone than the one with Zelensky today. Why were they chosen as envoys of Europe? Was that a strategic move?
Yeah, unquestionably so. I mean, Macron has probably one of the best relationships with President Trump right now out of European leaders. Viktor Orban aside, he has spent a lot of time with Trump in the past. He knows how to work with him. He effectively love-bombed him in the Oval Office earlier in the week. He called him Dear Donald four times. There was all this reaching out and touching of each other's backs and touching his knee and all of this, you know, sort of designed to show that Macron is on side. The second thing is that Britain and France are the most powerful European countries militarily. So it makes sense if they were going to Washington to talk about helping Ukraine end the war that you send someone with military clout. And then from Britain's perspective, Starmer's relationship with Trump was, well, it was more of an unknown, but we did know that there was no bad blood between them. And the response from what we saw from both yesterday, it appeared to be very warm, much more sort of positive and warmer than a lot of people expected. And Starmer also had that Trump card of a letter from King Charles and a state visit to the UK to offer. And I mean, have a listen to Starmer handing over the letter to Trump in the Oval Office yesterday.
It's an invitation for a second state visit. This is really special. This has never happened before. This is unprecedented. And I think that just symbolises the strength of the relationship between us. So this is a very special letter.
And of course, those state visits, Carolyn, as you know, they come with all this pageantry and banquets and stage coaches and all the pomp that goes with it. And we know from Trump, he loves that kind of stuff. And I guess, you know, Starmer hoped with this sort of offer and with this sort of praise for the US leader that Europe would be able to get Trump back on side again.
The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Berry. Thank you so much, Orla.
Thanks, Carolyn.
This week, tens of thousands of seeds from around the globe were flown to a remote airstrip above the Arctic Circle.
Goodbye and take care.
Svalbard, Norway is the world's northernmost permanent human settlement. It is also home to the Svalbard Global Seed Vault. Buried in Arctic permafrost, this facility is a climate-controlled warren of tunnels and storerooms. Nigerian scientist Alu Ramat was shivering outside the massive front door of the seed vault to mark the occasion.
And it is important for seed bank and communities and researchers to deposit their seeds here for long-term storage, because at Svalbard Seed Vault, your seeds stand a very good chance of being available for humanity now and always.
The CEO of the Center for International Forestry Research, Eliane Ubali-Juro, flew in from Nairobi carrying a box of seeds from 13 trees native to African countries. By safeguarding tree seeds today, she wrote, we are ensuring their availability for generations to come. Norway's State Secretary of Food and Agriculture, Hanna Berit Betekken, was there to welcome international seed emissaries.
This is not only a symbolic act. It's a part of each country's security policy.
The vault plays a role in rebuilding seed collections damaged by natural disasters and war. It's also about ensuring crop diversity as the climate changes. Norway built the seed vault in 2008. It welcomes seed deposits from every country and stores them free of charge. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Public outrage boiled over today in Athens. Protesters threw rocks and Molotov cocktails at police outside of Greece's parliament building. They're angry about a deadly train crash that killed nearly 60 people, most of them students, 2 years ago today. Many people in Greece are outraged at the government's failure to prevent the crash and the official response that followed. Eleni Stamatoukou is based in Athens, where she writes for the news outlet Balkan Insight.
For Greeks, this train crash has been transformed into a social trauma. Greeks, they see in train crash how the governments of the last 20 years have treated them and express their anger and their disappointment. There is a big frustration as the investigation is still dragging on. They're very unhappy with the way the Greek government handled the whole situation, and they accuse them for covering up the case.
Can you tell me what people are so angry at the government about regarding this train crash?
The investigation is still ongoing. The case file has not been closed after 2 years. It's still dragging on for 2 years. This is the first thing. Also, there is very big frustration that because there are so many details published from the case file, this audio file that proves that there were people alive, that they survived the collision and they were burnt. Another detail that was published again is this report that was published yesterday about the fire that was provoked by a flammable material, an argument that was not supported by the experts that were designated by the state.
So more information is being revealed that was not revealed in the original government investigation. And is there also a concern about, the conditions that led up to this accident?
The problem is that there's not safety in the train, in the railway. After 2 years, they haven't done anything in order to renovate the system, the safety system from the safe transportation of the passengers, according to the Greek National Railway Company.
So there's been little done to restore people's faith in the safety of the railways, it sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand also that aside from all these issues we've been talking about with the train crash, there are other things that people are protesting.
Yeah. Besides this, their disappointment about the whole situation in Greece, how they treat to the people. There was a report published in February disclosed that 60% of Greeks say that their income is not enough to live. And also around 82% of people are unable to save money. And around 12% of people, they say that they live in conditions of extreme poverty.
What has the government response been to all these protests that you say are the largest in many years?
Until now, we don't have any response. We don't have an official response by the government. Greek Prime Minister, on his Facebook account at the beginning of the protest today, wrote that human error was combined with the failures of the Greek state. And that's why he says that this is the fight in order to defeat the mistakes of the past.
Eleni Stamatoukou is based in Athens, where she writes for the news outlet Balkan Insight. In Barcelona, outside of the surrealist Sagrada Familia Church, a lone engraver of glass leans into a grindstone 6 long days a week. His name is Toni Moya, and he's among the last of his kind in Spain, a craftsman etching the finest of designs by hand into high-end crystal cups, glasses, and vases. The World's Jerry Haddon takes us into his workshop.
This is how an ordinary wine glass sounds when you make a toast. And this is what Toni Moya works with. Do you hear how beautiful that crystal is, Moya says? It's like the fading peal of a bell. There's something else here that's fading. This profession, Moya laments, standing in his small windowless workshop. It's lined with shelves of goblets, glasses, tumblers. I have two sons, the 60-year-old tells me, but sadly, they've chosen other career paths. Moya, who learned this trade from his own father, says he can't find any apprentices because engraving glass is hard and tiring. Moya hunches over and shows me. As the stone spins, he presses a glass against it, maintaining constant pressure with his hands. All the while, he's getting sprayed by water that's trickling onto the stone to keep things from overheating. There's no room for error, he says, slowly spinning the glass. I've got to press the glass to the stone exactly along the guidelines. Moya's wife, Rosa, draws those lines on the crystal. These aren't simple patterns. A single glass can have dimples, etchings, crisscrossed hatchwork. Each one is unique and can take hours to finish, polish, and pack. While I'm there, a vase arrives from a super yacht docked in Barcelona's port. It's got a cracked base, and the owner wants an exact replica. Who exactly the owner is, we can't know. He's made Moya sign a confidentiality agreement. For these clients, privacy is sacred, he tells me, holding up the $3,000 vase. This particular client is from England, he says, but orders come in from a lot of Russian vessels, too. But Moya's main business is cocktail bars. His dad landed a bunch as clients back when cocktails first became a thing in Spain in the 1960s. In fact, the crystal Moya's etching today is for a legendary coctelería here in town called Belvedere. Like Moya's workshop, the Belvedere feels like something from another era. The owner, Ginés Pérez, shows me his crystal cups and wine glasses. They all have the same curvy etchings, inspired by the actress and socialite Zsa Zsa Gabor. She was once a client, Pérez tells me, showing me a drawing of her framed on a wall here. Pérez, a 73-year-old man in an elegant suit, says he's been buying his crystal from Moya for over 40 years. It's like the difference between buying furniture at IKEA, he says, or having a craftsman build something exclusively for you. As we talk, Pérez drops ice into a crystal whiskey glass. He says Moya's crystal is a finely tuned musical instrument. But crystal, unlike, say, diamonds, does not last forever. It breaks, gets chipped. More than one inebriated client has sent their gin and tonic crashing to the floor here. That's okay, Pérez says, as long as Moya's around to replace what breaks in the line of duty.
Bueno, espero que me avise y ya le compraré un stock para que no tenga problemas.
He just better give me advanced warning before he retires, Pérez says, so I can stockpile. For the World, I'm Cherry Hatton, Barcelona.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The Mexican government has sent 29 notorious drug cartel operatives to the United States, where they're expected to go on trial soon in federal courts. The Trump administration has been demanding that Mexico crack down on the cartels, with the president repeatedly threatening to slap new tariffs on exports to the U.S. Chris Dalby is the director of the think tank World of Crime and advises governments on how to deal with organized crime.
On first glance, this is an unprecedented move. These are all high-value targets that the U.S. has been after for a long time. Of course, they range in importance. At the top, we absolutely have Rafael Caro Quintero, one of the most wanted men in the U.S. connected to the murder of DEA agent Kiki Camarena. He is an absolute get for the U.S., someone they've been after for multiple administrations for multiple years. Just behind him, you have the Trevino Morales brothers, two of the most high-ranking members within the Zetas, who ran that organization at the peak of its notoriety in the 2010s. But you also have leaders of cartels that are active today, the Gulf Cartel, the Jalisco Cartel New Generation, smaller groups as well. This is a cross-section of cartel history, past and present. That's the first glance. The second glance is that this is a PR coup, but operationally, it means very little.
Tell me more about that.
All 29 of these men were behind bars already.
Hmm.
Some of them for many years. Caro Quintero was apprehended a few years ago. The Morales brothers have been in prison for many years. So these are not leaders who are going to change the dynamics or weaken the cartels in any way. The cartels have already moved on from these leaders. Caro Quintero is an old man. This is a show of compliance by Mexico to show that it is willing to play ball with Trump. This will allow the White House and Mexican governments to say, look, we're progressing in our relationship. We're willing to reach a deal. And these men should absolutely be behind bars. There's much less risk of them escaping or returning to their activities in the U.S. On that, that is undoubted.
Mm. You mentioned this is a sign that Mexico is willing to play ball with the Trump administration. Basically, do you see this as actually a response to the threat of tariffs from the Trump administration? Or could this be seen as an extension of cooperative efforts that have been long underway?
This is an easy win for Sheinbaum, for President Sheinbaum. She gets rid of 29 high-value targets that will no longer be clogging up her jails. She temporarily placates the White House, and it costs her nothing. This did not engage cartels in a new way. This does not cost any lives. These were not men who were picked up for this purpose.
Do you think that this signals anything about Mexico's approach to cartels at all? Any signal that this is a more aggressive era of cracking down on them?
The reality so far in the Sheinbaum administration does not bear that out. It has in fact been very disappointing in terms of any new policy ideas or any new, more structured long-term planning in terms of either addressing the economic factors that let cartels thrive or going after them in new ways. There is an outsized influence on the kingpin, on this, what we call the decapitation strategy, that somehow removing the top guy or killing the top guy, whether it's El Chapo or Caro Quintero or whoever, is going to change anything. There's always a dozen lieutenants in the wings that can take over a cartel. And in fact, data shows that when you remove a long-term cartel boss, violence increases because the groups tend to fragment and there's a sort of civil war would happen inside of a group for smaller slices of the pie. We're seeing that right now with the Sinaloa cartel. The Sinaloa cartel was the absolute backstop for the Mexican drug trade for 30 years. And now, after the arrest of El Mayo last year and his extradition to the US, it's imploding and violence is through the roof. So again, this obsession with the kingpin is not good for actually reducing drug trafficking.
Is there a better technique or approach?
I mean, and they're not as sexy and they're not as easy and they're not as digestible. Following the money is what proves to be effective time and time again. Choking these guys in their bank accounts and in their cryptocurrencies is what hurts them. Removing the odd leader doesn't eventually matter. Drugs will keep moving. Understanding how they move financial flows across border, understanding how they launder money. And that requires international collaboration. And that starts with intense intelligence sharing and collaboration between the U.S. and Mexico. At the moment, there's little sign of that happening.
And why is that? Why is there a lack of cooperation and intelligence sharing between the U.S. and Mexico when it comes to cartels?
The Mexican law enforcement is sclerotically corrupt and has shared information with top cartel leaders going back years. However, there is also a lack of long-term planning, I think, especially in this administration in the U.S. I think this is an administration, and it's not the only one, that has played for the short-term news cycle, for the quick PR win over consistent actions that would reduce drug threats in the long term. That's something that is more difficult to explain to a demanding public.
Chris Dalby is the director of World of Crime and an expert on Mexican cartels. He's based in the Netherlands. In 1937, the Nazi Party in Germany organized one of the most notorious art exhibits of all time and included stuff by the best and brightest like Paul Klee, Marc Chagall, and Vasily Kandinsky. But the show intended to ridicule the works, calling them degenerate. A new exhibit at the Picasso Museum in Paris brings some of these same artworks back together. It's called Degenerate Art, Modern Art on Trial Under the Nazis. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
In 1937, the Nazi Party actually organized two exhibits in Munich. The Great German Art Exhibition opened to much fanfare. It showed the work the Nazis approved of, Greek and Roman sculpture celebrating athletic bodies and ideal beauty. Down the street was the exhibit of work the Nazis deemed Entartete, degenerate, about 650 works jammed together in dingy exhibition rooms. Otto Dix, Max Ernst, Picasso.
I had heard nothing about this degenerate art exhibition. I stumbled onto it. It wasn't on my itinerary.
One of the visitors to the exhibit was Josephine Knapp, an American art student traveling through Germany. She was interviewed in the 1993 documentary Degenerate Art, The Nazis versus Expressionism.
I saw pictures crowded together, some on burlap, some crooked, badly lighted.
It was a claustrophobic affair.
Peter Gunter saw the exhibit when he was 17. He was also interviewed in the documentary.
The walls were not hung in the normal things, but were plastered with works of art. Some of the pictures without the frames, some of the abstract pictures upside down, with graffiti written behind them and above them and around them.
The art was divided into different rooms by category. Art that was blasphemous, art that was made by Jews and Bolsheviks, art that criticized German soldiers or offended the honor of German women. One room had only abstract paintings, and it was called the Insanity Room. Here's what the exhibition catalog had to say about it. Quote, in the paintings and drawings of this chamber of horrors, there is no telling what was in the sick brains of those who wielded the brush or the pencil. The idea wasn't just to mock modern art, but to show viewers that it was a symptom of a disease, says Sander Gilman. He's a cultural historian at Emory University in Atlanta.
The Nazis, they're good at doing this. I'm sorry. They're really good at doing this.
He says they hung the art next to paintings done by psychiatric patients.
And they say, look, these paintings look just like the stuff the crazy people do.
The exhibit on Now in Paris displays the work with dignity and seriousness. Some of the pieces were in the original Antarte de Kunst show in 1937. There are also works that had been confiscated by the Nazis in 37 and 38 because the work in the Antarte de Kunst show was only a fraction of what was confiscated by the Nazis. In all, they took 20,000 works of art from museums and public collections and called them degenerate. Nazi officers kept their favorite paintings. Goering, for example, took a Van Gogh and a Cezanne. The rest were sold to fill Nazi coffers or burned in a giant bonfire in Berlin in 1939.
When you begin to work on a project on degenerate art, you have to realize that a lot of works that you would like to show in an exhibition are destroyed.
Johann Popillard is the co-curator of the Paris exhibit. He spoke to the Art Newspaper podcast.
In this exhibition, there is what you can see, but also what you cannot see, but that you have to have in mind.
So, for example, in the first room, the complete list of artists targeted by the Nazis covers an entire wall. They're written in gray letters. The names of those who were able to fit into this exhibition at the Musée Picasso are printed in black. They're drops in an ocean. And you realize the enormity of the Nazis' attack on modern art.
We have just 60 works of art, and this is a very small part of all the works that were confiscated during the period. But they are like the witness and the porte-parole.
The representative.
Of the others that you cannot see.
There have been exhibits about degenerate art before with more paintings. There were three in the U.S. in the 90s and then several in Germany. But what's unique about this one is the historical moment we find ourselves in, says Sander Gilman at Emory. He says today right-wing populist parties are seizing control of the arts.
In Poland, it was an attempt to rewrite the history of Poland through taking the museums over. In Hungary, it's exactly the same thing. There is a resurgence of a kind of 19th century Hungarian artistic nationalism. And in Italy, there's an attempt really now to create a new museum of what in other times would be called Italian fascist art.
And in an eerie parallel, says Gilman, the current degenerate art exhibit opened in Paris the same month Donald Trump declared an end to woke art in the United States.
The state oftentimes supports the arts, right? But very rarely does it say what art is not. What we're seeing now is a return not only to advocacy, I accept advocacy, but also to demonization.
It's hard, he says, not to see the Paris exhibit as a cautionary tale. For the World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
The holy Islamic month of Ramadan is expected to start this weekend. That means Muslims across the globe will refrain from eating and drinking from sunrise to sunset for the next several weeks. It is a month for religious reflection, getting together with loved ones, and also TV. Karim Shaheen explained. He's a writer with New Lines magazine based in Montreal.
So picture this. You wake up in the morning, you have the pre-dawn meal, you try down as much coffee as you can in order to get through the rest of the day.
Relatable.
Yep. And then you get to work and the coffee can only, you know, take you so far. When you come back home, hopefully a little bit earlier, because in a lot of places in the Middle East, during Ramadan, work hours are shortened. So you get back home, you take a short nap or maybe a long nap, and then you wake up and it's still an hour before sunset when you're able to eat and drink. And that hour moves at an absolute snail's pace. It feels like it's never ending.
Mm.
And so you sit down in front of the television and you start watching. And that's why it's the season for the launch of a lot of Arabic soap operas. Ramadan is sort of peak television viewing. It's also the time when you spend a lot of time with family around the iftar table. That's the evening meal. And afterwards, you also sit down and watch a lot of television together.
Mm. So are these mostly limited run series that last the length of Ramadan, or is this when, you know, the new season of popular new shows is launched?
Yeah, so it's both. I mean, when I was a kid, we generally had those limited run series anyways. They were usually around 30 episodes. You'd think that they were crafted for Ramadan itself. And they will generally span a plethora of different subject matter. You'll have the social storytelling, you'll have comedies, and you'll also have these big historical epics. You know, people are in touch very much with their religious and spiritual side during the month. They reflect back on the state of their societies. And one way they do that is also by looking back to historical episodes. So this year, there's a show called Muawiyah, which is a show about the first Umayyad caliph, one of the first people to sort of lead the enormous expansion of the Muslim empire in the 600s and 700s.
We actually have a clip from that series.
Muawiyah, لقد أتيت فضلا عظيما بأن تكون كاتبا للوحي.
هل أصابك سحر محمد؟ Karim, I know you've written about this series in the past. What are you expecting from it this year?
Yeah, so the character of Muawiyah is obviously a very compelling character. He became the fifth caliph. He took power after a deal with the prophet's grandson, with the assumption that he was going to give up power near the end of his life so that the prophet's progeny would rule in his stead. And then he reneged on that decision and passed on rule to his son, thus founding the Umayyad dynasty, one of the greatest dynasties of the Muslim empire. And this led to the great schism between Sunnis and Shiites, because his son ended up ordering the death of the prophet's grandson, Imam Hussein, who is the founding father, so to speak, of Shiism. So he's a very controversial figure. The show was supposed to air last year, and Saudi Arabia decided to put it on hold after objections from Iraq, which has a large Shiite population, amid sort of improving relations between the two countries. And now that the series is coming back, it'll be really interesting to follow the conversation there and whatever controversy is caused by the airing of the show. Obviously, it's been put on ice for quite some time, so naturally, there must have been some changes that have been made to it to make it more palatable.
Mm, interesting. Another upcoming series that is also getting attention is Ish Ish. It follows the story of a belly dancer in Egypt who's just got to make ends meet. Here's a clip from the trailer for that one. So this is the main character here introducing herself as a belly dancer, saying she's the daughter of a belly dancer, the sister of a belly dancer. Tell us more about this series, Karim.
Yeah, I mean, belly dancing has always had this fascinating, you know, place in Egyptian culture where a lot of famous belly dancers are, you know, well-known household figures. But nevertheless, the profession itself is seen as this shady, disreputable profession, let's say. And as a result, the lives of these individual characters have always been super compelling to people, both in Egypt and across the region as well. So the belly dancing theme in particular is particularly fascinating, given that Ramadan is obviously, you know, a religious occasion. So it's all kind of a big sort of pop culture festival running alongside a presumably, you know, ascetic religious tradition as well, where you're supposed to be fasting and you're supposed to be reflecting. And that contrast has always driven the conversation about what you should be doing in Ramadan. Should you be sitting there and watching all those television shows, whether it's about belly dancers or about old Muslim emperors and caliphs, or should you be maybe praying and kind of living a somewhat ascetic life and thinking about your relationship with God and about the deprivation of the rest of humanity that doesn't have the same privilege as you? And that's always been the central tension of watching these shows during Ramadan itself.
Mm. And it's a global conversation, I would imagine, right? I'm assuming here that Muslims around the world are watching these shows?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's a lot easier to watch them in the region, obviously. So, you know, people get around and figure out ways to access it because it's such a part of the culture that, you know, even if you're living in Canada or you're living in the States or you're living far away from friends and family who are absolutely essential to the way you spend the month, you're still going to figure out a way to access these shows so you can talk about them. It's all over Instagram. It's all over social media. Everybody's talking about them when they're not talking about all the food prep. So if you want to be a part of that conversation, you have to figure out a way to watch those shows, even if you're abroad.
Karim Shaheen is the Middle East and Newsletters Editor at New Lines Magazine. He spoke with us from Montreal. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. If you decide to get married, there is a question: what to do about last names. In Japan, it's not much of a dilemma. Married couples are required to share a surname, and it's almost always the woman who takes the man's name. There's no same-sex marriage there. Reporter Rebecca Rossman recently found out that the law has far-reaching consequences, and there are growing calls for change.
Growing up in New Jersey, Julia Onishi, a Japanese-American, says she never really thought much about her last name. But after moving to Japan, falling in love, and getting engaged, she was told she had to make a choice. Either her husband would take her last name or she would take his.
I felt like it was going to be harder for him than for me to change my name, so we just decided to go that way.
Seemingly overnight, Julia Onishi became Julia Inuma. The law requiring families to have the same last name dates back to 1898 during Japan's Meiji era. At first, Julia says she didn't think her new surname would be a big deal.
But actually, it really was.
There was the paperwork, changing passports, driver's licenses. And in Japan, everything is tied to your surname.
So like at work, people only use their surnames. If you make a reservation, it's by your surname. So I didn't really realize like how much of an impact that was going to be.
Then came the existential question about her identity. Julia is a journalist who had been recognized by her byline under her maiden name for years.
And I kind of lost that along the way. So it's kind of like, I'm not sure what I want to do.
Many women do want to keep their last name because they identify with it.
Brigitte Steger is a researcher at the University of Cambridge specializing in modern Japanese society. She says that there have been calls since the 1980s to change the law, but emphasizes that Japan's societal structure means that change won't come quickly.
What the Japanese system really shows is that the family is the basis for society and not the individual. And that makes it so difficult to change. The welfare system, the registration, everything is based on this idea that the family is in charge.
Recently, there has been some progress. Last year, Japan's largest business lobby called on the government to allow couples to keep their birth names in the official family registry. A recent shift in government leadership has also sparked speculation about broader reforms. Still, change remains slow, despite widespread public support for allowing couples to keep separate surnames. I can feel that shift in public opinion as I walk through Tokyo's Shinjuku neighborhood, where I stop a mother and her 20-year-old daughter to ask about the surnames law. When she was growing up, 54-year-old Asuka Odagawa says the surnames law never really came up. Changing your name was just something all women did without really thinking about it, she says. But then she looks at her daughter, Takara. I want her to have a choice, she says. They smile at each other and nod, the older generation acknowledging a new one. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman, Tokyo.
Finding balance is one of life's constant battles. In Sweden, people rely on a concept that's been around since the days of the Vikings. It's called lagom, and it's about doing everything in moderation. The world's Bianca Hillier explains.
When Mikael Klintman was a young kid growing up in southern Sweden, he remembers telling his grandma the common refrain, "I'm hungry." In turn, she taught him a lesson and said, "Imagine traveling back in time 1,000 years ago."
She said, "You're at a Viking feast with food and beer and a platter of fish and porridge. So you ask, okay, how much can I take? And the answer you will get from your neighbor is you should take lagom."
Lagom. It's a very Swedish concept that Klintman came to know as taking only your fair share, so there's enough left for everyone. It's a group-oriented mindset.
It comes from log, which means team, and om, lagom, means around.
Centuries later, practicing lagom remains central to Swedish culture, and it can mean a bunch of different things. For example,
we tell our teenagers, boys who have started to work out, well, do it lagom, don't overdo it, and so on.
The idea is also embraced in conversations.
You talk for a while, but then you make sure to listen and make sure to even it out.
In other words, say just enough and don't take up too much airspace. That's true in the Swedish business world, too, says Christina Rundkrantz. She's a consultant who helps people from different cultures work together.
Swedes have a very special business culture. It's focused on equality, it's the team.
From interns to CEOs, she says decisions are made through consensus so that nobody dominates the discussion. That example of lagom, she admits, can take a while.
It's good for certain products, I'd say, but in many ways when the world is moving fast and we want an agile business culture, it could definitely be perceived as slow. Yes, you see it daily in Sweden, daily.
Nikki Brantmark noticed that when she moved from London to Sweden over 20 years ago.
It's a much calmer, slower pace of life.
Brantmark found the lagom way to be a breath of fresh air. Her corporate job actively encouraged a work-life balance, and she says lagom even came in handy during the COVID-19 pandemic.
People are very respectful of each other's space, personal space,
making social distancing a non-issue. If it all sounds too good to be true, well, sometimes it can be.
Today, we have a widened wealth gap.
Mikael Klintman again.
Which makes the sense that we are one community a bit fragmented into smaller groups.
Klintman now studies the concept of lagom. He's a professor of sociology at Lund University. He says rapid immigration has also put a strain on some elements of lagom. And then there are the instances when people just take lagom too far.
When it becomes performative, then we easily get annoyed.
Years ago, he worked at the Swedish behemoth IKEA and once saw Ingvar Kamprad, the company's founder, crawling inside a delivery truck to make sure everything was packaged properly.
Multi-billionaire, of course, had come there randomly, and he always flew second class and so on. And that annoyed some people, actually, because you shouldn't pretend you are middle class or working class.
Klintman explains that being perfect at being lagom kind of defeats the purpose, because everything, including lagom itself, should be done in moderation. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Be good to each other and join us back here on Monday.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Robert Lang, Stephen Salyer, Curtis L. Scribner, Frederica and Howard Stevenson, the KRPL family, and Robin Torres. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.